Hey everybody, welcome to another exciting, scintillating, and fun episode of the OIG Roundtable. I am Eric Rubenstein, Senior Director of Litigation, Fraud, Waste, and Abuse Support, and I am here with my two compadres, Wade McFall, retired Assistant Special Agent in Charge from the LA Field Office, and now a manager on our SIU investigative team, and Matt Kachansky, retired Special Agent in Charge from the OIG and the retired Northeast UPIC Director, and now Chapter 3, the Payment Integrity Director here at Advise. So today we want to talk about the unlicensed providers, exclusions, investigations that involve unlicensed providers. And, you know, we're getting a lot of feedback from people that are watching this. By the way, I won't disclose names, but somebody in the senior leadership at HHS OIG Office of Investigations reached out to me the other day, told me that they listen to the podcast when they're driving in their car, and they're calling it investigative 101 or Medicare 101, but says that the podcast has been a great positive tool in education and training. So we appreciate that. We appreciate that feedback, and continue to ask that people provide us with topics and issues and things that they want the three of us to pontificate about in future episodes of the Roundtable. So shout out to the people that are watching and listening and joining us each week for the OIG Roundtable to get our perspective on fraud, waste, abuse, and compliance issues. So we want to start, you know, talking about I've seen over the past couple of weeks a number of cases that have involved criminal and civil matters relative to the use of unlicensed or unqualified out of scope of authority type positions where providers are using unlicensed people or people that are not qualified to do certain types of work, and then billing out those items, services, and procedures to the Medicare program, the Medicaid program, and commercial. And there's lots of anecdotes about these different cases. We've all worked them. They're actually fairly commonplace. I've had cases involving everything from unlicensed people who were working, coming in off the street, doing physical therapy to patients. I had a case involving an instance where a provider had five locations. He was an internal medicine doctor, was performing physical therapy in his office, had unlicensed people off the street doing work. One of the tests that they were doing, or one of the modalities, was an ultrasound type test. And it had a gun that would get hot, it would get heated up. And one of the issues is that if you're not properly trained on how to use it, you can burn people's skin. And that happened. And when that happened, the people would tell the patients that that was just part of the healing process to kind of negate it. Oftentimes, you see that these cases involve similar cultural groups because there's a less of a chance that people are going to question things of that sort, particularly when you're preying upon an older population such as the Medicare population. But something that's an interesting piece of this puzzle is that, you know, as part of the early parts of the investigation, it's having really good quality interviews with the members, the patients, the beneficiaries, whatever you're calling them, because those are going to be some of those initial contacts are going to be the ways that you're going to learn and be able to identify the potential issues that are out there. So Wade, you know, you talk to people every day, all day now, you know, in the role that you're in and being here, and obviously as an agent and as an ASAC and all your career. Having a really solid foundation when you're doing an interview and knowing those facts and knowing to ask those questions, and even in instances where maybe the allegation has to do with an upcoding case, maybe the allegation has to do with services not rendered, it's sometimes bringing in some of these other aspects to either expand an investigation, refocus an investigation, but also to create consistency. Meaning, if you're talking to these people about, did you get a certain service? It doesn't hurt to ask, do you know who did it? Do you know anything about them, right? Let's talk a little about kind of that. You know, it sort of falls into this whole premise of a complete interview where you're trying to touch upon a number of things to rule out things, but also not limit yourself.
Right. And part of that, I think, is, excuse me, as you alluded to, that a lot of it gets back to the basic investigating 101, and that's when you're going to go interview somebody. And I say go, and now it's less in person, and it's over the phone. But doing the preparation to know all the facts that you can know and know which questions you're going to ask and kind of predict the answers and where you're going to go from there. So the preparation to an interview is very important in a case like that, obviously. And one of the other things that I was, when you were talking about that, I was thinking about one of the cases that we worked recently where it was members were getting this vein ablation procedure where somebody would basically inject something into varicose veins. Probably not a very, the actual technical part of it probably wasn't, you know, complex. It wasn't brain surgery, but it was supposed to be performed by the physician and not some kind of a tech. And we requested records. We're looking at medical records and we're trying to determine who actually was doing the procedure because there are allegations that it wasn't the physician. And from the records, it's hard to tell because they have notes and they have graphs and it's showing the vein and there's initials by who we think did the procedure. And then the physician is saying, well, that's not who did it. That's who was part of the procedure, but not who was doing it. So it boiled down to basic interviewing techniques where, again, it's a little bit more difficult in this role because everything is remote. It's telephone interviews, and I think it's just more difficult to get to the bottom of what you're trying to get to the bottom of over the phone as opposed to being in person with somebody. But you ask the questions of the member, and it's like, well, who did the procedure? And they maybe don't, they know who the doctor is, but you kind of have to break it down into, no, who actually, you know, put the needle in your vein? I know the doctor was there, but who did this? A lot of times they won't know who it is, but they might, you get a lot of common like references that say, oh, I don't know her name, but she's a Puerto Rican girl, or there was a Filipino guy that did it. And you get the same thing over and over. You hear a lot of people say it was the Filipino guy or the Puerto Rican girl, and that's not the doctor. So no matter what the doctor is saying or what the charts that he's documenting are saying, if the member is saying it's a Puerto Rican woman or a Filipino guy and the doctor does not fit that description, that's pretty good evidence that the doctor is not doing the procedure. Yes, he might be there in the hospital, in the building. He may have checked you in or came in to check on you, but whoever did the procedure is not him. And there could be other instances where it's a incident two situation, but we've gotten to the bottom of one fact that the doctor is not the one who's doing the procedure. And that's just basic interviewing. You know, if you just ask the question and move on, they might say, oh yeah, the doctor's there, or Dr. Smith, whatever. Right. Yes, he's my doctor, but is he the one who's, you know, putting the needle in your vein? That's, you have to break it down into very simple, right, yes, no questions, especially when there's a lot of times there's a bit of a language barrier. I only speak English. And if there's, that can be very difficult for me to get my question across clearly and for me to interpret the answer. But it really boils down to asking the very basic questions that you can't, like yes or no questions that are simple, not drawn out questions where you're confusing somebody or the answer is going to be confusing. It's like, who did the procedure? Who put the needle in your vein? It's that simple a lot of times.
Yeah. And I mean, what you're really talking about is old school gumshoeing, right? It's just, yeah, you know, use the phrase from film noir, but it really is it's gumshoe work. You know, and the thing that's interesting is, you know, what you're really getting to the heart of the matter is oftentimes these people that are doing these procedures, when it's not the doctor and you're going in for repeat procedures, oftentimes there's a recycling of people, or there's a carousel of people, and it may not be the same person every time. Or, you know, there may be some identifying thing, whether it be, you know, oh, this person is Filipino, they're Puerto Rican. Oh, you know, it was a guy with blue spiked hair, like something that's a unique piece of the puzzle that lets you know that. And then, you know, the other piece for you, you were just talking about how there may have been initials. You know, there's nothing wrong with going back to the provider and asking for an employee list and seeing who all the employees are. And then, you know, here's The initials are WM. Hey, I have an employee named Wade McFall. Like, you know, again, it's just putting pieces of that puzzle together. And sometimes it just, it takes, I think it always falls into the category of do your homework beforehand. Preparation is the number one thing. Go through a number of those medical records. And then when you're calling up your members, you might have a list of initials or names, and there's nothing wrong with saying, hey, does the name Wade McFall mean anything to you from that doctor's office? Oh, you know, it's funny that you say that. I remember now seeing that the person had on their scrubs, it said Wade, right? There's always these things that people don't necessarily think about that you have to kind of think about. It's a little bit of a chess game. You've got to anticipate where that person might be thinking without them knowing that they may be thinking that. So you have to do that. And that's just part of that completeness. But it is an important piece of the puzzle where speaking to those members is going to really help you. And then, you know, the follow-up is going to be ensuring, is this person trained, authorized, because is it a licensure issue? Is it a certification, right? In some specialties where they have, for example, ultrasounds or things of that sort, where the person must be certified and or have a license, there's some regulatory issues there. So a lot of these pieces can fall into place on that determination of whether or not that person is authorized to do the work. Or not authorized to do the work based upon scope of practice. And is it the unlicensed practice of medicine, unlicensed practice of physical therapy or dentistry or, you know, whatever it is. And oftentimes I think we see these instances where the person is a foreign medical graduate. So they've been in the medical school or dental school or whatever in the country that they're from, but they haven't either gotten licensed here. Maybe they don't have the requisite skill set to be licensed here, whatever it may be. But culturally, they knew somebody who was, and they go work in that same environment. So, Matt, you know, this then gets to the next piece, which is that, you know, it's not just unlicensed, but there's also the effects of exclusion. I know we've talked a lot about exclusion and the fact that, you know, you've got to check these things to make sure when you're bringing people into your practice, number one, are they licensed? Are they certified? Are they whatever the requirement is for that person to do the job? Because ultimately, it's under your Medicare provider number. It's your responsibility. You're ultimately the person that the authorities will turn to about whether or not you have maintained proper and adequate training and education and licensure for the people. And it, you know, it falls into the same thing about if you go astray of this, that you're going to have people that are, for example, they could be licensed, but if they're excluded, that's going to create a kind of a collateral problem. And when you were at OIG, you had the, I don't know if it's the pleasure, maybe depends upon the day, the honor of running the exclusions team. And I think, you know, one of the biggest complaints that comes out of hearing about exclusions is the fact that the exclusions process takes time and it is not contemporaneous with either a civil settlement or a criminal prosecution. And we're not going to get into the details of exclusions today because there are mandatory exclusions, permissive exclusions, and all of that. And under civil authorities, people are not automatically excluded. So we don't want to get into the kind of the nuts and bolts into the weeds of it. But it is important to note that there oftentimes is a lag between the exclusion. And that's why it is important to do basic backgrounds on your providers so that you don't have people that have a license revocation issue, are in the process of being excluded because of a conviction or something like that. And it's not just getting kicked out of Medicare and Medicaid, but there are a lot of collateral consequences of having unlicensed providers working in your practice and the effects of the exclusion on you and your practice for that.
Yes, there are. When someone's excluded from Medicare, there's an automatic exclusion from the Medicaid program as well, from the whatever state they may be licensed in, or wherever state the action took place in. And those exclusions are based on information gathered from multiple sources, whether that be, you know, from DOJ, from the OIG field offices that do their, you know, do their cases, and they send the documentation to the exclusion staff to do the exclusions, from the state licensing boards, from the state disciplinary boards. And the documentation requirements to effectuate an exclusion, you know, somewhat onerous. So it takes time to gather those documents, make sure you have everything. And then there's the time lag between sending someone an exclusion notice saying, here's your preliminary one, you've got so many days to debate this, appeal this, and then the final exclusion coming out. So it could be weeks, months, sometimes even years before that exclusion is finalized in the system. And when it's finalized, when Medicare excludes someone, then there's a Medicaid exclusion, and then that list every month of the newly excluded providers is sent to GAO and to the GSA, where they're then put on a debarment list. So that means no federal funding can go to this person. VA loans for homes can't get them. You know, all of those things. So if you're a grantee and getting grants from federal entities, federal agencies, and you're a provider group or a hospital, hiring an excluded person can have an impact on not just their salary and anything related to them specifically, but your overall funding from the government. So you have to be very, very careful in your hiring practices and in keeping up, you know, your exclusion checks every month, every 2 weeks, however you want to do it, to make sure that no one on staff is excluded.
And, you know, just to interrupt you for a second, you know, that brings up an interesting point. So, you know, I had worked on a case in New Jersey involving a whole bunch of providers that were involved in a kickback scheme involving an MRI facility. There were about 20 or 30 doctors. And three of the people that were involved all came from the same federally qualified health center, FQHC. Yeah. And they all got excluded and they all got terminated. And one of the doctors wound up getting rehired after she got out of jail. She got rehired by the federally qualified health center, and she wasn't seeing patients, but she was working to help train new providers to the FQHC on their EMR system. She was doing some quality control stuff. She wasn't even directly seeing patients. And so when we learned about it and we went and confronted the FQHC, they said, oh, no, she's not seeing patients. And we said, well, that doesn't matter because it's direct or indirect because there's a causation issue. And they said, well, we created a firewall, and her salary doesn't come from any Medicare, Medicaid reimbursements, which is the one way that you could theoretically do it, by creating a firewall where there's no money that comes across. And the big thing that becomes an issue is what they call fungibility. Is the money fungible, meaning is it all in one pot? And so we went back to the FQHC and we said, okay, give us the bank records of where she's getting her paychecks from. And they produced one bank account and all these bank statements showing her salary. And what was interesting was what they did was they tried to play a little game, and they started on the statements, they had the CFO, they would get, let's say, a deposit from United Healthcare or a commercial payer. And so they would get, let's say, a $30,000 payment. And let's say the doctor's salary was $1,000. They drew a line and hand wrote a $1,000 salary from a deposit, but it was all in the same bank account. And so they were trying to make it look like her salary wasn't really coming from Medicare, Medicaid reimbursements. It was coming from commercial payers, but they didn't have separate bank accounts. So they literally wrote on the bank statements, you know, check 320, which would have been like whatever her paycheck was. And they just drew a line next to a deposit from United Healthcare or one of the Blues or whatever it was. But it wasn't, you know, it didn't show anything. So there is that, you know, that collateral effect of, you know, of having people working for you that are excluded, where that fungibility exists and the impractical prospects of being able to do that. These cases are actually more common than not, particularly after someone has been prosecuted and has been excluded, but may not have lost their license, because where are they going to go work when reimbursements are typically in the Medicare, Medicaid spaces, or, you know, could be the bulk of the work that people are doing. But the collateral effects, there's a ton of them that continue to go on, because it's grant, it's loans, it's employment. There's a million things.
Correct. And the exclusions don't end like when the person gets out of prison. You know, if they had a 2-year sentence, The exclusion doesn't end then. The exclusion is for a set amount of time, or it could be indefinite, like for a loss of license and things like that. And they can only get back into the program when they submit paperwork to get back in. So it's not automatic. And then it's got to be approved by the IG's office that, yes, you can come back in. And it's not until that time that they become eligible again for all of those payments and all of that. So you have to,
and I
don't just assume that, oh, I served my time. I got my license back. And
I think that's a huge misnomer. That's a huge misnomer. People think that once they're eligible for reinstatement, that they're automatically reinstated. You being eligible for reinstatement, you still need to file a document requesting readmission. And the kicker that a lot of people, I think, don't always know or realize is that it is not a guarantee. You can be excluded mandatory for 5 years on a minimum on a criminal case. At the end of the 5 years, you must reapply, and there is no guarantee of readmission if you apply. You can still be denied admission back in. But I think that's an important piece, Matt. So, and talk a little bit about that, because that's something that the OIG, that's within their authorities, the whole readmission process. And I think the thing to always remember is that exclusion is not the same as termination. CMS issues a termination. OIG issues an exclusion.
Right. Yeah, termination is a separate administrative remedy from CMS. The exclusion, again, has those broader scope, and it's at the discretion of the OIG to readmit someone and remove the exclusion. And when they do submit the reinstatement paperwork, there's an investigation that goes on to see what that person's behavior has been since the exclusion took effect. You know, they check with provider, they check with employers, they check all of that, the probation office, to make sure that this person has rehabilitated. They want to make sure that this person is now going to be a good provider, a provider in good standing, before they let them in. And it could take weeks, it could take months for those investigations to go on. So it, again, keep checking the exclusion list to make sure that they have been removed before you bring someone on board.
And the last piece, Matt, as we kind of run out of time here, is one of the things that always becomes a criticism of exclusion is the amount of time it takes to be excluded. Where, you know, we've all seen instances where a provider is criminally adjudicated. Yes. Maybe they go to prison, maybe they have probation, maybe they then get on supervised release. But we see these instances of providers where the exclusion is years, sometimes a year, 2 years after they've done their time. Now, obviously, if you have somebody who gets a prison sentence of 2 or 3 years and they get excluded for 5 years, you know, do you want them excluded during the period of time that they're in jail? I mean, there's a lot of arguments about that they're kind of inherently excluded while they're sitting in the can waiting to get out. But there, you know, the lag in time is oftentimes one of the biggest criticisms. And I think the part of the puzzle that people tend to not understand is that a lot of exclusions that come to the OIG aren't necessarily from federal healthcare related investigations, meaning the OIG does the exclusions. And so one would think that an OIG case would get excluded faster, and it probably does because all the documents are contained within the OIG. But most exclusions do not come about from OIG healthcare fraud investigations. They come about from a combination of Medicaid cases, criminal MFUCU cases, licensure cases. A DWI for a nurse could result in an exclusion. So talk a little bit as we kind of wrap up, you know, where that sometimes that kind of inordinate lag is the result of.
Well, A, there's no reporting mandate for these other entities to send notification to the OIG of these convictions or of these actions. You know, this is all outreach done by the OIG to these entities. Please send us. It's doing social media research. It's doing, you know, DOJ, you know, press release research every month. The OIG staff, at least when I was there, they were all assigned specific states, and they would look to, you know, the U.S. Attorney's offices, the Attorney General's offices to work with them to get that information. But sometimes it just doesn't come. Sometimes, it, you know, you might find it 6 months later. And then, again, an investigation has to take place. There are certain criteria under which an exclusion has to take place. you know, for healthcare fraud. There are definitions of what that is. If that conviction meets those definitions, and it's attorneys from the OIG's office looking at the facts of the case to make that determination. So again, there's a delay in that. So it's, you know, it's delay in getting the information and then adjudicating that information to get to the final result of the exclusion.
And the other piece is that part of the exclusions process includes an independent review of the documents and an independent quote-unquote fact-finding mission. Because while there are criminally is a 5-year mandatory minimum exclusion, there are aggravating factors that can increase that. And the number one aggravating factor that I've always seen, which is the one that is often relied upon, is was the pattern of behavior greater than a year? Or more, which can be a huge factor in which you can get exclusions that can go way beyond 5 years. And part of that is because there is no automatic reporting. You know, it's one of those things where analysts have to go and troll state websites for things. And it's important to remember that states have independent exclusion authority on the Medicaid side. But what the OIG does is provide essentially a belt and suspenders. Because if you're excluded from Medicare, you're getting excluded from Medicaid. And that's a way to be able to get both going at the same time. But the big piece is because you've got 50 states plus Puerto Rico, Virgin Islands, you know, you've got probably 50, I think there's 53 or 54.
And if they're done at the county level, you've got those numbers of counties. I mean, and it's just, the information doesn't come automatically. There's no system set up for that. And it's these analysts, one by one, finding these things and then identifying them and then adjudicating them.
Right. Like in most instances, this is not a perfect system. It works a little bit smoother when it's an office, like where we were, office of investigations case, because, you know, and, you know, we all recall that when the case is adjudicated, there was a box that we would check on the case management system is subject, you know, is the subject excludable or should there be an exclusion case? You know, on any criminal case, you're always checking the box. Yes, that automatically created an exclusions case file, where all of the relevant documents would then go and an analyst would get alerted to that so that they can start that process and then come back if they needed more documents or if there was something that wasn't there that they thought they needed.
So if it's an FBI case, a VA case, you know, anything like that, you know, there was really nothing to manage. FBI did share their letterhead memoranda with us, but no automatic referrals.
Right. So you get into an office of investigations case where we didn't work with one of our law enforcement partners, or maybe we did, but there's information we have, right? That's very different than, you know, a VAOIG, OPM, postal, the alphabet soup of law enforcement entities that do healthcare fraud cases, where that information may not be as readily available because we as an OIG didn't have our hands in it. And so, you know, that has that additional effect. The other thing to keep in mind is that just because someone is unlicensed and gets criminally adjudicated for unlicensed, you know, submission of claims, whatever, that doesn't preclude them from an exclusion. You can be excluded whether you're a licensed practitioner or not. You will still get excluded. I mean, obviously, the exclusion effects are stronger when people have a Medicare provider number. But you can be excluded even when you don't have a Medicare provider number because it's sort of trying to anticipate, like, if you tried to get one, that you're not going to be able to get one. So, you know, these cases are becoming a little more prevalent. I'm seeing a lot of these lately. And I think part of it is because when you're talking about instances where reimbursements are flat or low, if you're able to get people in that are unlicensed, if you're getting people in that are unqualified, you're paying them a lot less money to do the work that you would otherwise need qualified people for. So, you know, for the public who aren't doing SIU investigations, know who your providers are that are doing this. Just because someone walks in wearing scrubs doesn't necessarily mean that they're a professionally trained, qualified, licensed healthcare provider. And then, you know, just to bring it back to what Wade said, as in from the SIU perspective, do your homework beforehand. Look at websites. See who all the providers are in the group if you can see them. You get those medical records. Look and see who's signing the records. See who's got initials. Look at the handwriting if it's a handwritten record or if it's initials on an EMR. So you can do so much due diligence before you actually speak to the member to ask them these collateral questions that may seem benign, but actually may have some probative value in an investigation. So good stuff. It's it's tough stuff. We're drinking out of a fire hose here. More cases, never enough people. But as always, good insights from you guys. Enjoy it. As always, thanks to everybody who tunes in. Again, the website, advise, advizehealth.com. Get our newsletter sent to your inbox every week. Our LinkedIn Lives every month. You can get those recordings. You can get the OIG Roundtable podcast on Spotify, our YouTube channel. Get it on in your inbox from the weekly newsletter. Also, get it through LinkedIn. It comes out every Thursday or so on LinkedIn. So we enjoy interacting with all of you. Enjoy talking about these topics. Thanks, as always, to you guys for taking the time. And we'll see everybody on the next OIG Roundtable.